Thank you very much, Sandhya, for the gracious introduction. I'd like to begin by thanking Chelsea Drazen, Tim Gordon, and Candice Parr from the Melbourne Journal of International Law for their able editing, obviously, of the journal, but also for inviting me, and, of course, the Institute for International Law and the Humanities at Melbourne Law School. So let me be self-policing. So forget sovereignty, the nomos of the sea and people in small boats. Forgetting sovereignty, what does it mean to forget sovereignty when its excesses are all around us? As if sovereignty can be forgotten, but also sovereignty must be forgotten. So we're in that double bind of not being able to do without sovereignty, to get rid of sovereignty, to forget sovereignty, but also that we have to follow the injunction of the sovereignty that needs to be forgotten. So as if sovereignty can be forgotten, my forthcoming book is focused on the as if in modern law. And the as if goes back to a tradition at least as old as Immanuel Kant's Critique of Pure Reason. Very early in the Critique of Pure Reason, Kant says that any civil polity must proceed as if law and society originate by way of a universal reason. That is to say, no law or society should look too closely into the origins of the law, because if they were to do that, they would find an illegitimate and brutal violence. And there is few or no law or society that won't have that. This tradition or this notion of the as if can be traced through a number of quite prominent thinkers. In the 19th century, Hans Vaihinger picked up on the as if around the centenary of the Critique of Pure Reason and published a book called The Philosophy of As If, considering the place of the as if across many disciplines in religion, physics, linguistics, and mathematics. Probably the most prominent jurisprudent or legal theorist to pick up on the as if explicitly was Hans Kelsen, who thought of the Grundnorm as an as if, that there would be this regressive attribution of each norm to a higher norm, and that you would proceed as if every norm was hanging on another norm. More recently, philosophers such as Jacques Derrida and Jean-Luc Nancy have developed the notion of the as if, and literary theorists like Frank Kermode. So that's the sort of trajectory that I'm trying to draw on in order to think about the place of the as if today. Overall, in this lecture, I'm trying to do two things. First, to examine sovereignty as a problem of sovereign knowing and seeing. So when we talk about whether we can forget sovereignty, it is a problem of knowing and seeing what the sovereign can know and see. And what does the sovereign know and see? Well, usually, in the context that I'm going to talk about them, the sovereign is knowing and seeing persons and bodies. And in that context, the second part of the lecture is about whether persons can be their own sign. So that's the second problem I'm looking at. Can persons or bodies be their own sign? And I'm going to try to explain these two problems through two examples that I'll begin talking about. Now, the first pertains to the British Indian Ocean territories in the middle of the Indian Ocean. The British Indian Ocean territories is a territory held by Britain since 1966. The history of it is that the archipelago was ceded to Britain by France in around 1814. And Britain then held it as part of the territory of Mauritius. During the period of decolonization after the Second World War, the Americans persuaded the British that they needed to separate out the territory, the territories of the Chagos archipelago, and not hand them back to Mauritian sovereignty. And this was, of course, the period of the height of the Cold War, and the Americans were interested in having a base in the Indian Ocean. So the motivation for the establishment of BIOT, as it is known, was a security and defense interest of the United States. As the U.S. State Department stated in 2000, its military base in Diego Garcia is, quote, an all but indispensable platform for the fulfillment of defense and security responsibilities in the Arabian Gulf, the Middle East, South Asia, and East Africa. And we already see here a sovereign imperative, obviously, to the establishment of the territory. Now, in order to establish this facility, the Chagos Archipelago had to be emptied of its population. And so, as with many imperial endeavors, a desert needed to be created. And, of course, we stand on ground today, which had to be rendered a desert in order for it to be colonized and settled. The islands of Biot were populated for generations by the Ilwa. They were the descendants of indentured laborers who had inhabited the islands since the 18th century. But in order to make the islands available to the U.S. to create the requisite desert islands, the population had to be expelled. Moreover, this was done in a way that deliberately cast the inhabitants as those with no rights to inhabit the islands. The economic activity on the islands had been the production of copra. So the Crown purchased, the British Crown purchased the private law interests in the land from the company that owned it. Now, as a non-self-governing territory, Biot and its population were subject to the protections of Chapter 11 of the UN Charter. This required members of the UN with responsibility for these territories to report to the Secretary General on social, economic, and political developments, as well as to protect self-government. So one of the motivations for expelling the population was to avoid these international obligations. In 1966, the Colonial Office, the British Colonial Office Minute, admits this with candor, to quote, "It would be highly embarrassing to us if, after giving the Americans to understand that the islands in Biot would be available to them for defense purposes, we then had to tell them that they fell within the purview of the UN Committee of 24, the Committee of 24 being the UN committee charged with decolonization. Another official refers to a certain old-fashioned reluctance to tell a whopping fib, or even a little fib, depending on the number of permanent inhabitants. In a note dated the 24th of August 1966, the permanent undersecretary of the Colonial Office states, to quote, "We must surely be very tough about this. The object of the exercise was to get some rocks which will remain ours. There will be no indigenous population except seagulls who have not yet got a committee." And in brackets, I'm still quoting here, "The status of women committee does not cover the rights of birds." End of quote. It's quite interesting, of course, that many of the suffragettes and others campaigning for women's rights in the 19th century, of course, were writing precisely to make the point that animals and birds had more rights than women in the 19th century. So it's an interesting kind of reversal here. Now, another official, a Mr. Greenhill, comments, quoting again, "Unfortunately, along with the birds go some few Tarzans and men Fridays, whose origins are obscure and who are being hopefully wished on to Mauritius. When that has been done, I agree we must be very tough, and a submission is being done accordingly." So I'm particularly interested in these Tarzans and men Fridays, as you will see, because much of the rest of the lecture is going to be concerned with Robinson Crusoe and the figure of Friday and what the figure of Friday represents as a body, as a sign, as something or a person that is within or not within sovereign visibility. And I want to take this figure of Friday, the birds, the beasts, onto discussing Australia's accession of various islands in the Indian Ocean and the potential for the excision of the entire continent from Australia's migration zone. So that's where I'm heading with this. So there's ample documentation to suggest that a primary objective of the British government was to concoct the sense that the islands had no indigenous population. A Foreign Office memo addressing it under the title Maintaining the Fiction. So here this is the production of the as-if, the as-if that is absolutely fundamental to this sovereign assertion. Then followed the implementation of the wholesale removal of the Chagossians under an ordinance in 1971. I don't have the time to go through all of the history of what took place in the ensuing decades. Suffice it to say that the Chagossians or the Ilwa wound up living in slums in Mauritius. There were, of course, members of a British territory, British subjects. So this is what Britain did to its own subjects. They were entitled to passports, and some of them wound up in London, living in Croydon, which is probably something of a sentence. But anyway. There were negotiations that involved some payment of compensation through the early part of the 1980s, but also with many of these kinds of negotiations, and you'll be familiar with this in the Australian context, of course, the state acts as trustee, and not always as a trustworthy trustee. Signatures take the form of thumbprints on pieces of paper, largely illiterate population is made to sign up to a scheme of compensation, which of course comes back to haunt them many decades later. In 1998, when Tony Blair was elected, and the then Foreign Secretary, Robin Cook, was promoting an ethical foreign policy, the Chagossians brought an action in the Divisional Court in London to be returned to the Chagos Islands. And in the Divisional Court, Lord Justice Laws read the ordering council created in 1966 to the effect that the clause that suggested that the territory had to be governed for the purposes of the peace, order, and good government of the territory suggested that the population could not be removed. Surely peace, order, and good government cannot amount to the removal of a population, the rendering empty of the territory to be governed. The Court of Appeal affirmed this position, and the Foreign Secretary at the time, Robin Cook, agreed that this was a shameful episode, and of course the Foreign Office had also discovered the various documents, some of which I was reading from earlier. And there was a scheme put in place for the Chagossians to return to the islands. And then, of course, the geopolitical landscape changed. 9/11 meant that the Americans were re-energizing their use of Diego Garcia, which is now amongst the largest U.S. military bases outside the United States, several runways, harbors large enough to take aircraft carriers, etc. And so the Americans insisted that the British reverse their position on this. By the time it gets to the House of Lords, even liberal judges such as Lord Hoffman, you might recall Lord Hoffman was the notorious judge who caused the first Pinochet case to fall because his wife was a member of Executive Amnesty International, and often regarded as quite a liberal judge, gives the main judgment in the House of Lords decision in 2009, suggesting that Britain had plenary power to govern the territory, and it effectively meant that it could do anything it wanted, including expelling the population. I won't go into all of this, but one of the issues was whether the European Convention for Human Rights applied to this British territory, and as with other territories, if Britain doesn't explicitly concede that the European Convention applies, it doesn't apply. And that issue had gone all the way through to the European Court of Human Rights in December, which refused to decide that particular point, but dismissed the matter on the basis that compensation had been paid. This was something that happened in the past, and it's not something that a remedy could be granted now. So that was the end of the matter as far as the Chagossians were concerned. Well, sorry, as far as the European Court and the judiciary are concerned, certainly not as far as the Chagossians are concerned. So what's significant for me here is the importance of this figure of Friday, and the fact that Hoffman, now in 2009, says the following. The Chagossians have, I'm quoting now, the Chagossians have not unreasonably shown no inclination to return to live Crusoe-like in poor and barren conditions of life. The action is like Banku number one, the first case in 2000, a step in a campaign to achieve a funded resettlement. So the Chagossians have ascended in the scale of social organization from being Man Fridays to Crusoes, but nonetheless, they haven't obtained their rights. And I'm sort of, I guess I'm kind of fascinated by the fact that judges keep referring to Robinson Crusoe, to Defoe's Robinson Crusoe. Robinson Crusoe, of course, is regarded as the first English novel and played a significant role in the modern imaginary. Rousseau, in his education treatise, Emile, suggests that Robinson Crusoe is a text to read to understand how nature can be tamed, and nature is tamed. Marx refers to Robinson Crusoe as an example of the relationship between man and object and use value. So it keeps recurring in modern understandings of what it means to be a capitalist man, if you like. So that's one of the senses of a sovereign knowing and seeing that I want to take with me now as I move to consider Australia and the boat migrants. So this is the Chagos Archipelago. And of course, some of the 19th and early 20th century renditions of the fantasy of Friday and Crusoe. So talking about Australia, boat migrants and excision zones is both a political and personal matter for me. I became a Tamil on the 25th of July, 1983. And what it means to become a Tamil, of course, means that your body as a sign has to be considered as standing for something perhaps other than what you perceive to be yourself. So as Derrida said in Monolingualism, the Other, referring to his own experience as a Jew who in Algeria, when the Vichy regime revoked the citizenship of Algerian Jews, and he says, "I speak one language, but it is not my own," which is to say, he was this French-speaking person who, of course, was deprived of his French citizenship and therefore ceased to be someone who could understand himself as a French person or indeed a French-speaking person. Is a kind of experience that resonates quite heavily with me as someone who speaks not a word of Tamil, who lived in a middle-class, grew up in a middle-class family, who eschewed notions of ethnic identity, lived in a conceited kind of way, probably, with an opposition between tradition and modernity, and saw that one was simply what one was thinking oneself to be, what language one was speaking, which in my case was largely Sinhalese. And a sovereign intervention occurs that transposes, that transforms what one can be, in a sense. So therefore, I say I became a Tamil on the 25th of July, 1983, during the pogroms unleashed on Tamils in Colombo. Thereafter, I came to Australia, not by boat, but on a Singapore Airlines plane. And of course, that does render my body as an occupier in this place, and I use occupier because, of course, we migrants are also part of a colonial project, a colonial project of settling this territory. I become an occupier that is a sign for a particular set of things. Firstly, a legal migrant, not an illegal migrant. And I'm really conscious of the chance, really, that determines that status. And what we're confronting today in the Australian response to this troubling and insufficient phrase, the boat migrants who are coming in large numbers to Australia, figures to December, to January 2013 had 17,000 boat migrants arriving. Around 6,500 of them were Tamils. And, of course, it is in that context that I'm trying to think through this problem of what it means to forget sovereignty. So you, of course, probably know the history of this. John Howard, 2001, sends special forces to deal with the HV Tampa, and there follows six pieces of legislation to deal with this extraordinary threat, or perceived threat to Australian sovereignty and territory, and the introduction of what they themselves called the Pacific Solution. So you know that history. I'm not going to recount it. And what we're faced with today is the Migration Amendment, Unauthorized Maritime Arrivals Bill 2012, which seeks to implement the Pacific Solution throughout Australia. What was an exception is therefore to become a norm. A new category of unauthorized maritime arrivals will discriminate against people on the basis of the mode of their journey to Australia. If you arrive by boat, you face mandatory detention in a harsh and remote place. Travel by air, and you will be able to apply for a protection visa on arrival. And of course, that's very unlikely because the airlines, as you know, operate as immigration officials in remote locations. Given most maritime arrivals are from Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, and Sri Lanka, the legal regime effectively implements a de facto form of apartheid based on country of origin. Australia's Migration Amendment Bill seeks to implement a staggering legal artifice for a nation that quite often claims to walk tall amongst the civilized. Now, the range of amendments, of course, to the Migration Act 1958 go back a long way, and it's not only this government or Howard, but, of course, Bob Hawke, that in 1989, the Hawke government radically amended the Migration Act to take discretion out of the system and to put in place a system of rules that would structure decision-making. And, of course, that decision-making has now become increasingly privatized. Under the Accession Act 2001, an offshore entry person can only make an application for refugee status if the Minister for Immigration decides that it is in the public interest to let the applicant do so. So you can see the level at which sovereign seeing and knowing, and what the sovereign allows themselves to see and know, and thus the projection on the body of the applicant takes place. Right. So to delve deeper now into the relationship between persons, bodies, place, and the law, what does it mean for these bodies and persons to be signs, to be produced to sustain a certain kind of sovereign as if? Because let's not forget that this excision of territory is an as if, right? It's an as if, it's a consciously false act to regulate a certain population. Now, the person I go to think about this is Carl Schmitt. In The Nomos of the Earth, Carl Schmitt characterizes nomos as the first measure of all subsequent measures. Nomos is linked to the first land appropriations, the partition and classification of space, and to primeval divisions and distributions. Schmitt wished to retrieve nomos from the misuse of the positivists of the 19th and 20th century and reinstate its energy and majesty, as he put it. Nomos was not to be regarded as a mere act by which is and ought could be separated, and it was not to be equated with regular acts, statutes, laws, measures, or decrees that mediate life. Nomos should not be translated as law, as gesetz, regulation, or other similar expressions. Schmitt stresses that, and now I quote from the Nomos of the Earth, nomos comes from nemein, the Greek word that means both to divide and to pasture. Thus, nomos is the immediate form in which the political and the social order of a people becomes spatially visible, the initial measure and division of pasture land, that is, the land appropriation as well as the concrete order contained in it and following from it. End of quote. So I'm really focusing here on nomos as the immediate form, so not mediated, the immediate form in which the political act and social order of the people becomes spatially visible, the creation of a territory, a spatially visible order. Nomos is what gives a spatially concrete unity by which a people or tribe becomes settled or historically situated, becomes visible in the appropriation of land during the founding of a city or colony. The treatment of boat migrants to Australia, I want to suggest, is in one sense a problem of sovereign visibility and knowledge within a social and political order. Now, Schmitt focuses on the orientational character of these original words like nomos and the spatial sense that allows one to recall that the core problem of every legal order is bracketing in the spatial sense. Schmitt's primary interest was the bracketing of war in the international order of the Jus Publicum Europaeum, as the order of public law amongst the erstwhile European powers. He also went on to compare the division of land and sea, the emergence of maritime powers, the becoming worldwide of Eurocentric order, and the emergence of a new nomos of the earth. Now, he's writing this, of course, in the early 1950s. He had been detained, of course, as a Nazi jurist, interviewed at Nuremberg, although he wasn't tried. Didn't have access to a library, and in a quite extraordinary way writes the Nomos of the Earth pretty much off the top of his head, which is really something. So, usefully for our purposes, Schmitt compares Nomos to the English term radical title, to be the English sort of land law term radical title, to be treated as original spatial ordering. I'd love to, of course, take a dip into Mabo now, but I won't. While the original act of land appropriation, such as establishing a city or a colony, is a nomos, nomos also has a future. There will be a perpetually new manifestation of nomos when space is appropriated in every historical epoch, Schmitt says. So I want to focus on the immediate and visible quality of this future nomos. Now, nomos is the juridicalized combination of animal and human bodies, and here I want to return to the birds, to Friday, and to beasts. Nomos is the juridicalized combination of animal and human bodies. You get these slides and you don't use them. See, sorry about this, but you get the picture here. Okay. Nomos is the juridicalized combination of animal and human bodies marked in space. As Cornelia Wissmann has argued, this is the primordial scene of the nomos, which opens with the drawing of a line in the soil. It is the opening scene of law, initiating a concept of law tied to agriculture, to tilling of soil, a sign of ownership. Cornelia Wissmann wrote a terrific book called Files, Law and Media Technology, which I would thoroughly recommend. I'm quoting here from a chapter in an edited book called Starting from Scratch, Concepts of Order in No Man's Land, in a book titled War, Violence, and the Modern Condition. Now, Schmidt's opposition between nomos and the concrete order of space and nomos as abstract normativism, which is the Kelsenian idea, is characterized by Wismann as a battleground between jus terendi, the law in relation to land, and jus scriptum, a kind of law through the notion of a written law or a more Kelsenian idea. So nomos manifests orders of territorial space and of writing, but it's also the body that marks the soil, and that's my particular interest here, the body that marks the soil, and attests to the human power executed in the land. Those are Wismann's words. I want to stay with the ox, the ox that pulls the plow in this Bostrophedon writing, as Wismann calls it, and the many beasts, such as the beasts of burden, pulling the plow. And it's to that relation between the beast and man, beast and sovereign, that I will now turn. Now here I draw quite heavily on Jacques Derrida's final seminars, or the seminars in the latter stages of his life that have been now translated and are published at least in two volumes, but there are more volumes coming, titled The Beast and the Sovereign. And I'm drawing from The Beast and the Sovereign, Volume 1, Seminar 11. In this seminar, Derrida talks about the distinction between the beast and the sovereign, a distinction that is, in French, rendered in feminine and masculine terms. So the beast is la bête, a feminine phrase, and the sovereign, la souveraine. So Derrida plays with this masculine and feminine distinction, but he's also playing about what he calls what beings and who beings. What beings and who beings, and there's a whole Heideggerian dimension behind this, which he develops in the second volume of Beast and Sovereign in relation to Robinson Crusoe, but I'll spare you the Heidegger. So the disruption has to begin at the level of knowledge, of what it means to know, see, cast one's gaze, have access to an object known, seen, and graspable. So that's the point of intervention Derrida wants to make, and it's what I draw on and want to make in relation to the boat migrant as a body who is a sign. So the scene for the deconstructive encounter in Derrida's work is an autopsy, an anatomical dissection that takes place before Louis XIV, the archetypical sovereign in 1681. And what happens in 1681 is that an elephant is brought before Louis XIV, and the elephant is dissected with a great deal of fanfare. And Louis Maron has written about this in his fantastic book on sovereignty. And Derrida draws heavily on that. The Maron's book is called The Portrait of the King. So what we're seeing in the context of this autopsy is a kind of sovereign absolute knowing, the sovereign that can have a kind of theatre of knowing performed in front of him by way of this autopsy. The absolute knowledge of the sovereign also extends to history, Derrida says, the sense that everything is known in advance for the sovereign. Derrida draws on Maron's book, The Portrait of a King, to express the as if, the simulacrum effect or fiction of the sovereign spectacle. Absolute knowledge means that everything happens as though, quoting Derrida now, as though it were known in advance, and thus like marionettes, programmed and providentially prescribed. I'm quoting Derrida there. This historiography of the sovereign creates in the reader-spectator the simulacrum, the illusion that he is the one who is pulling the strings of the marionette of history. This is the as-if that is central to sovereignty. I quote Derrida now, sovereignty is this narrative fiction or this effect of representation. Sovereignty draws all its power, all its potency, its all-powerful nature from this simulacrum effect, this fiction or representation effect that is inherent and congenital to it. End of quote. All this means that sovereignty does not exist as such. And that is one of the reasons why we can even chance forgetting sovereignty. Sovereignty is an economy of distribution of simulacrum effects. Notions such as transfer, translation, transition, tradition, inheritance, economic distribution are the site of the divisions, transactions, and negotiations of sovereignty. These are the productive sites for dividing an absolute way of sovereign knowing and seeing. The fiction of excising Christmas Island, or other islands, or indeed the continent from Australia, is one such simulacrum effect of sovereignty. It is to treat space and the boat migrants as marionettes. Space and beings are the effects of fictional representation. In the name of sovereign Australia, an absolute all-seeing, all-knowing knowledge is claimed. The people arriving in boats are already deemed economic migrants, rather than potentially people fleeing persecution. They're subject to a logic of fairness that casts the persons arriving as gaining an advantage they don't deserve. The policy is driven by the notion, of course, as you know, of no advantage to those who arrive by boats, as distinct from those processed in UNHCR camps outside Australia. But what does it mean for bodies in these excise spaces to be differently discernible? What structures of representation will be drawn on to access these people in small boats fleeing one island of persecution for, it seems, another? What signs and markers of intelligibility might structure the difference between boat migrants as who or what beings? So really, for the boat migrant to be a different kind of sign, they have to move from being these what beings, the queue jumping economic migrants, to who beings, who are signs of what remains to be determined, not something that is predetermined, pre-known, pre-seen by a sovereign. And that, of course, is why discretion is so important, a discretion in a system to make these determinations. Now, I'm going to skip for reasons of time. I'm going to return, in the longer paper, I return to a much closer reading of Robinson Crusoe. And importantly for me, J.M. Coetzee's rereading of Robinson Crusoe in his 1987 novel, Foe. And Foe, of course, is a play on Defoe. And Defoe, Daniel Defoe himself, was a Mr. Foe who added an aristocratic prefix to his name. So let me tell you a little bit about that. Another reference, actually, that you might find interesting in all of this is Joseph Slaughter's work. I wanted to mention that. A forthcoming chapter in a book edited by Kostas Douzenas and Connor Geertie. Joe Slaughter's chapter is called However Incompletely Human. And what's interesting about that, particularly for those interested in international law, is that he reads Defoe's Robinson Crusoe in terms of its centrality to the debates around the drafting of the UN Charter, and particularly Article 29 of the UN Charter, which is, to quote, everyone has duties to the community in which alone the free and full development of his personality is possible. Of course, this is a provision that tries to reconcile a kind of possessive individualism that otherwise drives the UN Charter with membership in a community and society. And as it happens, Robinson Crusoe was central to that. But let me now finally, last stage of the paper, move to think more closely about this notion of a body that is its own sign. And in fact, when we think about bodies being their own sign, I want to emphasize here that we're talking about a certain kind of impossibility, right? How can a body be its own sign? Because it's always going to be in relation to being seen, being perceived, being with, being in relation. And so there's always going to be a plurality that troubles the singularity of a body that seeks to be its own sign. So what is credibility and verifiability as it pertains to boat migrants and their claims to refugee status? I want to address this by drawing on the inhabitants of another island who also made their way in a small boat. Crusoe, Robinson Crusoe, as rewritten by Coetzee, in Foe. And of course, I have to now read Coetzee as, of course, a South African writer, but now also an Australian writer. And for those of you who read his new novel, The Childhood of Jesus, I can't read that in any other way than as an allegory of Australia and what is expected of migrants. Well, I'd recommend it. So Coetzee adds to Crusoe and Friday the missing woman in Defoe's text. Susan Barton, a figure taken, the name at least taken in terms of its intertextual analysis from Defoe's Roxana, and a character named Susan in that book. Foe is a text which, now Coetzee's Foe here, Foe is a text in which writing and representation is put into question within writing itself. A large part of the novel is narrated within quotation marks, whereby Susan Barton, the woman that Coetzee adds to Robinson Crusoe, the woman cast away on the island, narrates her story of being a castaway on an island with Crusoe and Friday to an author she meets in London called Daniel Foe. This memoir, along with the letters she writes to Mr. Foe when he disappears for a time, invites the reader to question the conditions under which narratives and stories are produced. Now, one key theme in Foe is whether Susan will, quote, father, and so there's a heavily gendered dimension to this interrogation that Coetzee is making. The key theme is whether Susan will be able to father a story and the terms in which that will be done. She repeatedly refuses to divulge all the elements of her biography or the events that preceded her becoming a castaway with Crusoe and Friday. She does not give an account of her daughter's disappearance. I choose not to tell it, this is quoting from the novel now, and Susan Barton. I choose not to tell it because to no one, not even to you, do I owe proof that I'm a substantial being with a substantial history in the world. I choose rather to tell of the island, of myself and Crusoe and Friday, and what we three did there. For I am a free woman who asserts her freedom by telling her story according to her own desire. End of quote. However, throughout the novel, it is Friday who remains silent and inaccessible. Friday is presented in Coetzee's Foe as the absolute other, to quote again from the novel. As Susan puts it, then there is the matter of Friday's tongue. On the island, I accepted that I should never learn how Friday lost his tongue. Friday has had his, apparently, because we don't definitely know this, has had his tongue cut out. As I accepted that I should never learn how the apes crossed the sea. But what we can accept in life, we cannot accept in history. To tell my story and be silent on Friday's tongue is no better than offering a book for sale with pages in it quietly left empty. Yet the only tongue that can tell Friday's secret is the tongue he has lost. Now for Attridge, who analyzes this text, the problem presented here is not just the liberal humanist dream of hearing each other's stories, but a very different kind of hearing, hearing each other's silences. Okay, so what do we hear of bodies arriving on these shores? What do we see of them? So this brings us back to the problem of the modes of representing the boat migrants and their captors on the islands excised off Australia. Australia refuses, in the manner of an encounter with what beings, beasts, the visibility of the boat migrant. They're not visible for the purposes of migration or refugee status. The entire continent might soon be excised for the purposes of maritime arrival or as a place of sovereign seeing. It's a kind of self-blinding. And yet this is also the action of all-knowing sovereign who knows in advance, who claims absolute knowledge about the queue-jumping refugee who wants to gain an unfair advantage. It is a re-spatialization, a new nomos in the sense that Schmidt articulated it. It is the anxious return of an absolute sovereign reorientating its radical title. And here I think great parallels, although I haven't developed it in this paper, to the situation of the Chagossians, a sovereignty that seemed to be being adjusted, a justice that seemed to be being, however limitedly, done in relation to a past set of injustices, that then becomes much more absolute as the geopolitical landscape changes. But we still have the problem, we know what the state is doing in its narcissistic hunt for boats. But what are we to make of the figure of the refugee or the migrant, or indeed, what can be the sign that we see? Now here I think there's a very important contribution being made by Emily Howery's work. Emily's here, did terrific research on this issue in Sri Lanka. She's a Lebron Fellow with Columbia Law School and is on leave from the Human Rights Law Center, where she was Director of Advocacy and Strategic Litigation. And her unpublished article, Time to Leave, Mixed Motivations of Sri Lankan Boat Migrants to Australia, is what I will end with. In her research, Howie interviewed a number of returnees to Sri Lanka, amongst other people. And I take this story from her work about a woman she interviewed, a Tamil woman, living in the militarized northern province, who had tried to leave Sri Lanka by boat with children and was intercepted by the Sri Lankan authorities. In the course of the interview, she reveals to Howie that initially she had tried to leave the country, quote, for the future of her children, to improve her children's lives. And to that extent, it's a kind of commonplace concern, the sort of concern that gets interpreted as being an economic migrant like everyone else in the eyes of immigration authorities. However, as they discussed her case further, it emerged that this woman, and not using her actual name, but the name that Harry adopts, Brahmi, discloses that, quote, her husband had been disappeared 5 years earlier, taken from their home and not seen again. Since that time, CID visited every month, and as she said, they would, quote, stay a short time if my children were there, but longer if they weren't. They would call me and ask to go somewhere, that kind of thing. CID has a phone number and she gets midnight calls. So in Brahmi's words, to quote, they know I'm alone, so they're trying to get a benefit. So by the end of the interview, in a sense, she reveals that you can be, of course, more than one thing, someone who seeks to improve your children's lives, but also someone who may well have a well-founded fear of persecution. How would that person be a sign of themselves if they're so readily categorized within the sovereign modes of seeing? If they're cast into the various categories that we find in the legislation, such as unlawful maritime arrivals and so on. I'll leave it there. Thank you.